From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Obama says ISIS militants are on the defensive. Belgian jihadists jailed as Europe tries to stem the flow of ISIS fighters. The significance of Egyptian-Russian talks.
I think that what the Egyptians want is for the Americans and Western Europeans to worry that Egypt is going back into the Russian orbit.
And climate change likely to displace millions as a migration crisis grows. I'm Susan Yawkey. President Barack Obama says his request for new war powers to fight Islamic State terrorists will prevent the U.S. from getting dragged into another prolonged ground war in the Middle East. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
Speaking to reporters Wednesday, President Obama said the militants are on the defensive and are going to lose. Mr. Obama has led the coalition effort against Islamic State fighters using the same authorization from Congress that President George W. Bush used in going to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the draft resolution he sent to Congress, the U.S. leader indicates it is time to fight the war on the Islamic State his way, and he is calling for the repeal of the Bush-era authorization.
The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war, like Afghanistan or Iraq.
Mr. Obama believes the United States should not get dragged into another prolonged war in the Middle East, something he said is not necessary to defeat the militants. That is why a key part of his request would limit the president's authority to wage war to 3 years. Mr. Obama said the authorization at the same time would give him the flexibility he needs to go after the militants.
For example, if we had actionable intelligence about a gathering of ISIL leaders and our partners didn't have the capacity to get them, I would be prepared to order our special forces to take action because I will not allow these terrorists to have a safe haven.
The authorization would remain valid into the first year of the next president's term. At that time, the new leadership would be required to revisit the issue. In seeking authority to wage war, President Obama also wants to prevent new involvement in an open-ended conflict. The resolution has bipartisan support in Congress, but its provision allowing a limited deployment of ground troops is expected to fuel a strong debate in the weeks to come. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
A court in Belgium has handed down jail sentences to 45 members of an Islamist group convicted of arranging for young men to travel to Syria to fight for jihadist groups. Most of those sentenced were absent from court, presumed to be fighting or killed in Syria. It's the latest in a series of prosecutions of European citizens who have joined terror groups in Syria. Henry Ridgewell looks at the successes and failures of attempts to stem the flow.
The group Sharia for Belgium, which is now disbanded, is accused of sending dozens of young men to fight with jihadist organizations, including Islamic State. Amid high security in the city of Antwerp, judges sentenced the group's leader, Fuad Belkacem, to 12 years in jail. Dimitri Bontink travelled to Syria in 2013 to try to bring back his son, Jejuan, who was given a suspended sentence Wednesday after agreeing to be a witness for the prosecution. Bontink criticised the decision to give long jail sentences to young people he described as brainwashed.
Is that a zeer spijtige manier?
They are being criminalized, and that way they will never return. And this way, we only create more fertile ground for terrorists and more hate and frustration against the West.
Officials say around 350 Belgians have traveled to fight in Syria, the highest number in Europe relative to Belgium's population. Overall, an estimated 4,000 Europeans have joined Islamist militant groups. Several countries, including Britain, France and Spain, are debating removing the passports and citizenship of those convicted of travelling to join terror groups. Security services are pushing for more powers of surveillance. It's a delicate balance, says Sajjan Gohel of the Asia Pacific Foundation in London.
The authorities do need to have the tools to be able to stop it, but whether those legislations that are being proposed by various European and Western countries can be implemented remains to be seen, because human rights and civil liberties will come into it, and the legal dynamics will be ongoing for many years potentially.
The proposals to try to tackle foreign fighters can be counterproductive, says Steve Crawshaw of Amnesty International.
Because they introduce a level of restriction without really addressing the actual crimes that have been committed. What we need is for laws to deal with crimes, and the criminal code is already there to deal with that. You don't want to broaden that out indefinitely. That's a very wrong way to go.
Sajjan Gohel says the West must tackle the propaganda to dissuade impressionable young Muslims from joining Islamic State.
They need to see that this group kills more Muslims than they kill anybody else, and that is something the West really needs to convey far more than it's doing.
Kurdish fighters, backed by US-led coalition airstrikes, prevented Islamic State from taking the key Syrian town of Kobani last month. This defeat could help change the perception of invincibility among potential foreign fighters, says Gohel.
They poured fighters into Kobani, took a lot of hits, a lot of resources were utilized, but they were not able to take the town. Symbolically, it has been a very important defeat for the group, but equally what they have tried to do to mask it is show videos of the hostages that they've taken.
Washington confirmed that Islamic State's last U.S. hostage, aid worker Kayla Mueller, was killed, though it's not clear how. Analysts say the group now holds just a handful of Western hostages. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The UN Security Council is expected to hear from UN envoy Jamal Bendemar today about the unfolding crisis in Yemen, where he has tried to mediate political reconciliation talks. Shiite Houthi militia have been in control of the capital, Sana'a, since September. Last week, they dissolved parliament. The president and his cabinet resigned last month. Wednesday, the United States, Britain, and France announced the closure this week of their embassies. The French press agency quotes a Houthi official as saying the closures were unjustified. A foreign ministry official is quoted by the New York Times as saying the closures are meant to put pressure on the Houthis. Visiting Middle East professor Nabil Khoury of Northwestern University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, because of the security situation, diplomats concluded they could no longer carry out their duties.
What you have now is simply a recognition by Western embassies that they no longer have state with which to deal. They no longer have anyone that can guarantee the security of their diplomats. And given the deteriorating security situation in Yemen, they can effectively not do their diplomatic work anymore.
The Houthis insist they're not linked to Iran. Is that true?
No, that is not. They are definitely linked to Iran. The only question is how deep that relationship goes. We've known for some time that they have been encouraged by Iran, have received funding from Iran. They've also received training and advice from Lebanese Hezbollah. All Yemenis know that.
What does this do for the U.S. effort against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
That, unfortunately, remains the major preoccupation of the U.S. I fault this with contributing to the deterioration of the country because we were so preoccupied with following al-Qaeda that we didn't pay attention to the internal politics and the deterioration, and we did very little diplomatically to help keep the country together. I think the chaos which is resulting from Houthis fighting other tribes and fighting southerners will be good for al-Qaeda.
There are reports Saudi Arabia is arming Sunni tribes in the south of Yemen. Are we headed to a civil war?
It's not necessarily going towards a full-scale civil war. It may be going towards a secession, though. The Saudis have armed Sunni tribes before. They're going to help the southerners probably secede, partly because they can then have part of Yemen that owes allegiance to them and can work with them. At the end of the day, it's really not up to the Saudis or anybody else. It's up to the Yemenis. They will either try to work something out and stay together as a country, or they will break apart with all the chaos and fighting that that entails.
Given the turmoil in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, Khoury says the region is in a long period of instability, with the balance of power tilting toward Iran. Economic ties dominated the agenda during a two-day visit to Egypt by Russian President Vladimir Putin. At a news conference, Putin and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi also pledged their countries to work together to fight terrorism and signed an agreement reinforcing military cooperation. The security challenge facing Egypt was underscored by fresh reports of bombings at three police stations in the city of Alexandria and the deaths of a number of suspected Islamic militants during air raids in the Sinai Peninsula. This was Putin's first trip to Cairo in almost a decade, although he has met President el-Sisi twice since the military took power in 2013. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy asks Mark Katz, professor of government and international affairs at George Mason University, how significant is Putin's visit to Egypt?
It certainly is significant. I think that Putin wants to show that Russia continues to be involved in the Middle East, and obviously he's been well received by the Egyptian government. So I think that it's meant to make a positive statement about Russian-Egyptian relations, and I think to a certain extent it has succeeded.
But what could Russia offer Egypt when its economy is suffering so bad?
Well, the truth is it can't offer all that much. Obviously, there is the arms package that the Russians have offered, but of course they want the Egyptians to buy it. Apparently, the Saudis have indicated in the past that they would do so, but they can't quite bring themselves to actually pay the money, and so it seems that the deal is not going well. Certainly, Russian-Egyptian trade is growing. Egypt is one of a very important buyer for Russian wheat, and of course, lots of Russian tourists visit Egypt. On the other hand, it's not clear that there are many further opportunities for them, at least not ones that would require a lot of investment, which under the current conditions, Russia really can't make that investment. And, of course, Egypt can't afford to pay all that much for Russian goods and services either.
How do you explain the Egyptian stress on restoring very warm relations with Russia at this point?
I think that what the Egyptians want is for the Americans and Western Europeans to worry that Egypt is going back into the Russian orbit, and so they will be very worried and will offer concessions to the Sisi government and learn to appreciate Sisi all the more. But quite frankly, I think that Western governments don't see Russia is in a position to offer Egypt much, especially now that Russia is increasingly preoccupied with Ukraine.
But would the rapprochement with Russia take away from U.S.-Egyptian strategic cooperation?
Talking to Egyptian officers, I don't think that they really see Russia as an alternative to America in this sense, that they would much rather continue to work with the U.S. What I do think, though, is that from the point of view of the Sisi government, to be seen domestically that Egypt can work not just with the U.S., but with a country that is at odds with the U.S., and there's nothing the U.S. can do about it. And I don't think the U.S. will do anything in retaliation, that the Egyptian-American relationship is very important. The curbs on American arms supplies that the Obama administration were made were actually not all that great, but it clearly upset the relationship. And I think when it comes right down to it, the U.S., although it's not happy about the way that Sisi came to power or the way he has ruled, in fact, the U.S. has very little choice but to work with him.
Mark Katz, professor of government and international affairs at George Mason University. Friday, we plan to bring you more of his remarks on the Egyptian-Russian relationship.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Environmental advocates warn of a looming migration crisis as a result of climate change. They're urging negotiators drafting a climate change agreement to include provisions aimed at preventing mass migration by helping vulnerable communities adapt to the new climate reality. Lisa Schlein reports from the site of the climate change conference in Geneva.
Polar bears live on sea ice. With the warming of the Earth's atmosphere, their habitat is melting. Unable to hunt in the open water, polar bears are dying, sometimes drowning, as they search for ice floes that have disappeared.
This video of polar bears teetering on top of floating icebergs is both shocking and moving. Special advisor to the Director of International Protection at the UN Refugee Agency, Jose Riera, says the polar bear has become the most emblematic image of climate change.
That's often invoked as perhaps the strongest image of the impact of climate change. We were completely struck, however, that the impact on people and how that impact would play out was in some ways missing from the discussions.
The UNHCR assists 46.3 million refugees, stateless people, returnees, and internally displaced. Many of these people already are concentrated in climate change hotspots around the world. Riera says climate-related migration and displacement will pose huge challenges in the years ahead. Just 10 months remain before world leaders sign a climate change agreement in Paris. The UNHCR official says little time is left for addressing the crucial issues raised by the specter of millions of climate migrants forced to flee their homes.
We hope that the parties will recognize that climate change is indeed a driver of human mobility and will likely increase the displacement of populations unless concrete measures are taken. The second big picture message is to encourage states to take measures to prevent and mitigate displacement in the context of climate change, including through adaptation strategies.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center tracks the number of people who are displaced by natural disasters. Director of the center, Alfredo Zamudio, says the trends are not good.
Our evidence shows that since 1970 until 2013, the risk to be affected for internal displacement has doubled. In 2013, almost 22 million people were displaced in at least 119 countries, almost three times as many people as displaced the same year by conflict and violence.
Since 2008, when the center began monitoring displacement, 160 million people have been displaced in 161 countries. The highest risks are in Asia, where countries are regularly exposed to typhoons, floods, and earthquakes. Scientists agree the risk of displacement will increase in the coming decades as sea levels rise and global warming increases the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events. Bernd Hemingway is director of the Department of Migration Management for the International Organization for Migration. He does not share the view that migration is necessarily bad. If managed well, he says migration can be positive and can hold out hope to populations. He says migration is an important adaptation strategy if supported by policy action.
In cases of natural disasters, there are no other choices than moving out of harm's way to save lives. In slow onset events, migration may help individuals and communities to become more resilient by diversifying livelihoods, ensuring access to key health and sanitation services and infrastructures, and by contributing to development and adaptation in the places of origin through, for example, remittances.
Environmental advocates agree the climate change agenda must give more prominence to the looming migration crisis. They say measures that would allow people to remain in their homes and not be forced to flee should be explored. They say planned relocations should be a measure of last resort when all other adaptation strategies have failed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new satellite is on a 1.5 million kilometer, 110-day journey towards the sun. Once it reaches its orbit, Discover, the Deep Space Climate Observatory, will replace an aging craft to monitor space weather. And it comes none too soon. 2015 marks the peak of the 11-year solar cycle when extreme weather on the sun can most impact life on Earth. VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports.
3, 2, 1, 0. And liftoff.
Discover is headed to a place in deep space where the gravitational pull of the sun and of Earth cancel each other out. That makes it an ideal spot for the craft to monitor the sun. From this faraway outpost, it will document the continuous stream of charged solar particles. Thomas Berger is director of the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. He says while we are mostly protected by the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere, large-scale eruptions from the sun called coronal mass ejections can still be dangerous.
So those are really, really large magnetic clouds that are expelled from the sun at very, very high speeds. And when those impact the Earth, that's like a tsunami, if you will, or a hurricane impacting the Earth in terms of space weather.
Violent space weather can disable electric power grids, knock out satellites, interrupt radio signals and aviation communication systems, services we depend on in our daily lives. Full recovery from a really bad solar storm could take 4 to 10 years and cost between $1 and $2 trillion, according to a recent scientific report.
It's really not much we can do about it, given that the sun is a gigantic star and we're just a tiny little planet in its orbit. However, NOAA's job, and the Space Weather Prediction Center's job in particular, is to predict these phenomena and give people the watches, warnings, and alerts that they need to take mitigational action.
Discover will sit like a buoy in space. It replaces ACE, the 17-year-old craft that has worked long beyond its design life. Berger says Discover will ensure there's no gap in real-time solar observations.
That gives us between 15 to 60 minutes to warn people on Earth that a very strong storm, for instance, if we measure it at the Discover satellite, is coming into the Earth. 15 to 60 minutes is enough time for power grid operators to take mitigational actions such as spooling up other generators to balance loads. It's enough time for satellite operators to take their satellites into safe mode if necessary. So it's enough time. We'd like more, of course.
Plans are underway for more instruments to provide that earlier warning.
It would be great if we had something even farther towards the sun. And that's possible using perhaps solar sail technologies in the future. But right now, what we can do is put something in that gravitational sweet spot, if you will, and leave it there. And that's the Discover satellite.
Discover, like ACE, will issue planetary-scale predictions and warnings. NOAA plans to use ACE data, too, as long as the aging satellite survives.
We can tell you something's coming in. However, with the ACE data in the future and developments in models that are very exciting, the upcoming models we're developing, we'll be able to tell you exactly which regions of the Earth will be more or less susceptible to these incoming solar storms.
This will mean, for the first time, warnings will advise not only that a magnetic storm is heading towards Earth, but where it will strike. Discover also carries 2 NASA Earth-observing instruments that will gather a range of measurements for other science work. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
And from the world of sports, Tiger Woods said his golf is not acceptable for the professional circuit, and he will not return until it is. Woods shot a career worst 82 to miss the cut in the Phoenix Open by 12 shots. He was playing poorly at Torrey Pines when he withdrew after 11 holes because of tightness in his back. The 39-year-old Woods said on his website that the injury is not related to the back surgery he had last spring. He said, quote, "Right now I need a lot of work on my game and to still spend time with the people that are important to me. My play and scores are not acceptable for tournament golf. Like I've said, I enter a tournament to compete at the highest level, and when I think I'm ready, I'll be back," end quote. His current world ranking, 62nd, is the lowest since he turned professional in 1996. Woods has not won a major tournament since the 2008 U.S. Open. He has struggled with various injuries in recent years. Woods has won 14 majors, second all-time behind golf great Jack Nicklaus. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. You can also listen to this show again or any of our international editions by going to the program tab and scrolling to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.